the Eighth Commandment, Part 4. In Deuteronomy chapter 5, Moses again provided the Decalogue to the Israelites just prior to their entering the Promised Land. And in verse 19, he reiterated the Eighth Commandment as, neither shall thou steal. Once again, a very simple command. Let me take a drink of water here again. Once again, a very simple command. Thou shalt not steal. But nonetheless, one with major ramifications, and one which, if we really are truthful, very few people seem able to keep. And that is, even speaking of many Christians today. Thank you, Dick. And one of the reasons for this is not so much that they don't want to keep it, speaking of the Christians, of course. Not so much that the average Christian doesn't want to keep the commandment, thou shalt not steal, but rather because the Eighth Commandment, like the other nine commandments, is seldom studied and taught with the statutes and its judgment in mind, or intact. And therefore, even among pronomian churches, those churches that are pro-law today, even among pronomian churches, the people are often uninformed and therefore unfamiliar with all that is involved in this commandment and the other nine commandments that we have certainly seen to be the case up to this point. In the previous message, we therefore began to examine some of the statutes which help to explain, or if you will, even unfold this commandment. I've never thought about it quite in that fashion before, but I like that, that the statutes that explain, that elaborate, that elucidate, are actually unfolding that very basic commandment. And so we started to look at some of the statutes that do that, that help to unfold, explain, and elucidate this commandment, this very important piece of Yahweh's legislation for His people and His kingdom. And His kingdom not just as it is in heaven, but as it is in heaven so that it might be the same here on earth. He doesn't need, by the way, you know, this is His legislation for earth. There's no problem up in heaven, I'll guarantee you, with breaking this or any of the other Ten Commandments. So what He has in mind is for here on earth, more so than it is has to do with in heaven. Therefore, we began, as I pointed out, to look at some of those statutes, and we began in Exodus chapter 20. So let's return to Exodus chapter 22. And resume our discussion where we left off. Exodus chapter 22. And in last week's message, we covered the first four verses. And so let's pick it up with verse 5. Well, actually, there's only four verses that we've covered. Let's just begin at the beginning of the chapter and read through verse 5 at this point. Verse 1 again says, "If a man shall steal an ox or a sheep and kill it or sell it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep." And of course, we dealt with the difference there, why there was a difference, or at least possible reasons why there was a difference in the last message. Continuing verse 2, it says, "If a thief be found breaking up and be smitten that he die, there shall no blood be shed for him. If the sun be risen upon him, there shall be blood shed for him, for he should make full restitution. If he have nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft." And we didn't actually cover those verses. We'll deal with those when we get to the judgment. But we dealt with verse 4 as well last week, which says, "If the theft be certainly found in his hand alive, whether it be ox or ass or sheep, he shall restore double." Now continuing verse 5. "If a man shall cause a field or vineyard to be eaten, and shall put in his beast, and shall feed in another man's field, of the best of his own field, and of the best of his own vineyard, shall he make restitution." Now let me read that from the New American Standard, because that's not real clear in the King James, and in fact there's some translation problems, just a slight translation problem that we'll eventually get to as well. But from the New American Standard, verse 5, for clarity's sake, it says, "If a man lets a field or a vineyard be grazed bare, and lets his animal loose so that it grazes in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard." You could say that this statute, in simple term, establishes grazing rights. And once again, note that restitution is the judgment, as it is always for the Eighth Commandment. That restitution is judgment for this commandment, and also that the benefit of the doubt if you will, at least in this instance, goes to the victim or the damaged party. In this case, the neighbor who lets his livestock graze on another man's property without prior agreement or appropriate compensation is not required. Note that it's that he is not required to pay only a commensurate amount from his own field, but in this case, he is to pay the very best portion or cutting of his field or his pasture. So it wasn't four times, as we found out, as it would be restitution when you stole a sheep or something comparable to a sheep. It wasn't four times, as it was with an ox or something comparable today to an ox. It wasn't even double, as it was in the case when the items were still found in the thief's possession. In this case, it was a commensurate amount, but it was to be the very best of his field or vineyard in that case. And I think that, again, giving the benefit of the doubt to the one who was damaged, who knows what that crop or product or the crop from the vineyard or from the pasture could have possibly brought, and therefore, the thief in this case would have to pay a commensurate part from the best of his field or vineyard. It should also be noted that this judgment was required even if it wasn't intentional on the part of the owner of the livestock. Restitution was required even if another man's pasture or field or vineyard was grazed as a consequence of the neighbor's neglect or irresponsibility. The Hebrew word shalak in this verse, from which the English phrase shall put in the King James Version or let's loose in the New American Standard Version, is the Hebrew word shalak, from which those two English phrases are translated, is defined by James Strong as following: a primitive root to send away for or out. Now that probably doesn't help you a whole lot, so let me read you a commentary that deals with this particular verse and this particular word. Kyle and Delisha's commentary says this about this. It says, if anyone should consume a field or a vineyard and let loose his beast so that it fed in another man's field, he was to give the best of his field and vineyard in restitution. Of course, we've already talked about that. These words do not refer to willful injury. For shalak, Old Testament 79:71, does not mean to drive in, but simply to let loose. So the New American Standard is a better translation in that particular instance. To set at liberty, they refer to injury done from carelessness when anyone neglected to take proper care of a beast that was feeding in his field, and it strayed in consequence and began grazing in another man's. Hence, simple compensation was all that was demanded, though this was to be made from the best of his field. End of that quote from Kyle and Delish. In other words, and catch this, and this is important, thou shall not steal. And we're going to spend some time on this, and I hope you don't get completely sidetracked from the statutes themselves, but this is important, so we're going to spend some time on this particular point, on elaborating on it. In other words, thou shall not steal, according to what we just read and according to the statute itself found in verse 5, thou shalt not steal covers or entails much more than simply willful or intentional theft of another man's property. Normally we think thou shalt not steal, it just means intentional theft. It includes much more than that. But also, in addition, any neglect that is the cause of damage to or loss of another man's property. And in the latter instance, the theft is not, now catch this, in the latter instance, the theft is not the initial act of negligence, but the second act of negligence. That is, let me explain it. Hopefully I can explain it so you understand that. That is, if a neighbor's property were damaged because of someone's negligence or irresponsibility, the actual theft would occur when the restitution is not made, which would constitute the second act of negligence, rather than the first time, because it was by negligence, it wasn't by intent the first time. Does that make sense to you? And so the theft is not in the initial act of negligence, but in the second act of negligence. In other words, the excuse, put it in more simple terms, the excuse, well, I didn't mean any harm by it, does not cut it with God. Under Yahweh's laws, if you're the cause of damage, you are responsible whether the damage was intentional or not. The commandment, like this commandment, like all of the nine commandments, provides much more than just the provision, just the proviso, the prohibition is a better word, against intentional transgression. Sometimes we just see those commandments in the negative. God always has the flip side in mind. And that's the positive as well. One of them is actually, at least one of them, the fifth commandment of honoring your father and mother, of course, is set in the positive. In that case, there's the flip side to that commandment as well. So keep that in mind. This commandment, like all of the commandments, contains much more than just the provision against intentional transgression, but its purpose, its intent, its design, if you will, is also meant to foster personal responsibility. And I suspect that's God's first intent with the commandments. To foster personal responsibility, or what else would you call that? About self-control. And there's a better word that I want to use, one that's, I think, better, at least in the context of what I'm going to share with you, and that's self-government. And I believe that's always been God's intent, that we be self-governed. And always doing what's right, fair, and equitable unto our neighbor in all instances. If you love your neighbor, that's of course what you're going to do. And think about it. Just think of all of the lawsuits today that are flooding our court system today that simply would not exist if that was the case. If we were following even just this one commandment once again. Dealing with it as God, being inspired by it as God intends us to. Fostering self-government instead of state government, if you will. If we would just govern ourselves and always do right. Always. Make it a point that we will always do right by our neighbor. Now, Paul wrote, he expounded upon the differences between being self-governed and state-governed to the Galatians and also to Timothy. How many of you knew that? Paul expounded upon the differences between self-government and state government. Josiah says he did. Well, it may not have used that terms, but I think that as we go through this, you'll see that in fact he did. Let's turn to first to Galatians chapter 5. Now, let's take some time with this, because this is very important. Galatians chapter 5, beginning with verse 1. Chapter 4, chapter 5. Galatians 5, verse 1, it says, Paul writes, and he says, stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ has made us free, and be entangled not again with the yoke of bondage. Now, that's one side of the coin. But as with everything, there's always a flip side. Especially with God. He's always got, especially if it's an extreme position, he's always got the flip side to counterbalance anything that would initially appear extreme. Now, somebody might say, well, that doesn't seem extreme. Everybody wants to stand fast in liberty so that we aren't under a yoke of bondage. Let me guarantee you, you take that too far. As often taken too far by the antinomian churches today, and you end up with the licentiousness that Jude speaks of in Jude chapter 1 and verse 4, in which we dealt with in the first part of this series, the first message of this series. And that is where he spoke of turning, you take standing fast in the liberty which you have been given, you take that too far and you end up with turning the grace of God into licentiousness. That is the license to sin. By the way, You know, you kind of evolve in your thinking with things as you learn something is wrong and you kind of move on. You know, initially when I read Jude chapter 1, I just always thought of licentiousness as being that which evil people do, the wicked, the sinners, the ungodly. And then I realized that really that passage certainly can include the antinomian churches today as well. Because that's exactly what they do. They take the grace of God. They say, we're no longer under law, we're under the grace of God. And they take the grace of God and they turn it into licentiousness. And so I realized that previous up until a conversation I had with someone over the phone after last week's message, that it would include the antinomian crowd as well. And while talking to this man, I realized, in fact, that it only applies to the antinomian crowd. That verse of Jude has nothing to do with the wicked whatsoever. Because think about it. They could care less about the grace of God. They don't turn the grace of God into anything. Grace of God means nothing to them. It's only the antinomian crowd that takes the grace of God, who's interested in the grace of God, and turns it into the license to sin. And so, Galatians 5:1 is an extreme if left by itself without the flip side of the coin. The flip side of the same coin is found in the same chapter in verses 13 and 14. Verse 13. Let's read verse 1 and verse 13, 14 together. Verse 1 again. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ has made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. Verse 13. For brethren, we have been called unto liberty. Only use not liberty for an occasion to the flesh. Licentiousness. Turning the grace of God into a license to sin. But by love, serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. That's the two sides of the same coin. And then consider also verse 18, and we're going to continue a little bit further from there as well, but verse 18 to begin with, where he says, but if you be led of the Spirit, you are not under the law. He goes on. So he's going back now to the other side of the coin, and he says, but if ye be led by the Spirit, ye are not under the law. The word under being the operative word in that passage. Christians who love Yahweh and their fellow man are not, get this, under, the operative word, under the law. Like non-Christians and other lawbreakers are. Now, many Christians today do not realize that only Christians are not under the law, and everyone else is. That is within the context of Israel and non-Israelites who would place themselves under the requirements of God's laws. But only Christians are not under the law. And everyone else is. Romans 10:4. We've looked at this many times in the past, but let me go over it again. And we've kind of emphasized always the first part more than the second half. This time I want to emphasize the second half where it says, for Christ is the end of the law. And as I pointed out on many occasions, regrettably, many Christians today may read the rest of the verse, but their thinking stops right there. Christ, see, Christ is the end of the law. We're not under the law anymore. Law no longer is a part of the new covenant today. Termed in multitudes of different ways. But notice what it says, for Christ is the end of the law for righteousness. Not the end of the law, period. He's the end of the law for righteousness or to be righteous. There is no justification by the law under the new covenant. But then also notes how the verse ends. It says, for Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone that believes. In other words, note that Yeshua is not the end of the law of righteousness for everyone, but only for those who believe in Him. Those who have taken advantage of the fact that He fulfilled the law. And so everyone else is still under the law, still under the requirements because they rejected Him. They're still under the requirements of the law to try to do everything they can to fulfill the law if they're going to have any chance of being righteous before God. Only the believing man and woman who's taken advantage of Christ is no longer under the law. Therefore, non-believers and other intentional lawbreakers are still under the law. That is, the Mosaic Covenant's requirement to keep it perfectly to be righteous is really what it's talking about. Now turn, keep, you might want to keep your fingers in Galatians 5 because we want to return there, but turn to a parallel passage, if you will, in this regard. 1 Timothy chapter 1, and beginning with verse 8. it says, "But we know that the law," now, again, I've talked about this in the past as well, but again, note, do not miss the context here. Paul is writing to Timothy, not before the crucifixion of Christ, but after the crucifixion of Christ. In other words, we are now in New Covenant times. These New Covenant times when, according to so many churches and Christians today, the law has been done away with. I don't think so. Not according to Paul. 1 Timothy chapter 1 verse 8. "But we know that the law is good." Romans 7, he said the same thing twice. The law is good. Everybody else wants to make, too many people want to make the law bad. I expect that. You'd expect that from non-Christians. But Christians today, the vast majority of Christians today want to make the law good, bad. It's bad, bad, bad. Under the new covenant. Not according to Paul. Paul says the law is good if a man uses it lawfully. Now what would be an unlawful use of the law, by the way? Well, that would be under the new covenant. That would be saying that, hey, Morris, you've got to keep the law to be righteous before God. You've got to be circumcised before, in order to be righteous before God. You've got to do this and that and that. That's an unlawful use of the law. So there's an unlawful use and there's a lawful use. He goes on, verse 9, he says, "Knowing this, that the law is not made for the righteous man, but for the lawless and the disobedient, for the ungodly and for sinners, for unholy and profane, for murderers of fathers and murderers of mothers, for manslayers, for whoremongers, for them that defile themselves with mankind, for men-stealers, for liars, or for perjured persons, and if there be any other thing that is contrary to the sound, to sound doctrine, according to the glorious gospel of the blessed God." Notice how this is according to the gospel, the good news of the new covenant, that these people are, that the law was made for them, "according to the glorious gospel of the blessed God, which was committed to my trust." Such people described therein are, in other words, under the law. And they are, or at least should be, if we had a Christian government today, they should be forced to keep it. Because they will not do so voluntarily. And if you think about it, that's the way it is with all law. What do you think it is today under American laws we have today? You've got people who, we'll name no names here, but who keep the speeding laws voluntarily. And then there's others who have to be kind of forced into it, if they can. But the point is, what's the big deal here? Who would you rather have, man's laws? In this whole scenario, it's the same. You get it one way or the other, the same scenario. Well, I'd rather do it with God's laws rather than man's laws. All right, so you've got, they are, you know, such people as described in 1 Timothy are under the law, and very clearly they are to be or should be forced to keep it because they're not doing so voluntarily, or they are to be punished by the law's judgments for their transgression of the same if they will not voluntarily do so or not be forced to do so. If they're caught doing otherwise, they are then to be punished by the law's judgments. And with that in mind, do not miss that according to Paul, the law is still in effect for such people, or should be. And that is the judgments in this case. And that they are even to be forced to keep it for such people. Remember that a Christian government doesn't bear the sword for nothing, according to Paul in Romans chapter 13. That's what he's talking about. He's talking about that a Christian government, and that's the only thing that's described in that passage, a Christian government doesn't bear the sword for nothing, doesn't have the power to execute judgment for nothing. It's to force people into it. You know, those who won't keep it willfully or voluntarily like Christians should. But also don't miss, And this is even more important, I think, at least at this point. Also, don't miss that the law is still in effect for Christians as well. We're not under the law, that is, forced to keep it, but instead you might say that we, the Christians, are above the law, keeping it voluntarily out of love for Yahweh and our fellow man. We're not under it. And I mean, there's some of our, some pronomian people who still talk about it. We're still under the law. Or not if you believe Paul and the other writers in the New Testament. We, as Christians, are not under the law. Get that in your heads. We are not under the curse of the law. We are not under the obligation of keeping the law righteous, because our righteousness, our justification, does not come by the law, but by Yahshua the Christ. And therefore, you could say, we're not under it. We're above it, if you will, because we keep it voluntarily. Now, go back to Galatians chapter 5. With all of that in mind, I hope I'm not skipping around too much and losing you in all of this. Galatians chapter 5 and verse 18 is where we left off. Let's pick it up there again. In verse 18 it says, "But if ye," speaking to the Christian Galatians and us as well, "if ye be led by of the Spirit, ye are not under the law." Now, note, it's those who are led by the Spirit who are not under the law. We'll come back to that here momentarily. But continuing, verse 19, it says, "Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, sedition, heresies, envyings, murderings, drunkenness, rebellions, and such like." We can stop there and say, basically, we have the same list that Paul, we just read from Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 1, 9 through 11. "Of which I tell you," continuing, "before, as I have also told you in times past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God." All right, now, again, that's essentially the same list. The deeds of the flesh is the same list that Paul said that the law was made for these people in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and 8. But also now note what follows. Starting with verse 22, it says, "But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, and temperance." And now catch this. "Against such, there is no law." In other words, such people as described in verse 22 that are fulfilling the fruits of God's Spirit, being led by His Spirit, are not under the law. There is no such law against such things. Or don't need, if you will, we could put it this way, don't need the law lording it over them, because they are already performing the law voluntarily. It doesn't do away with the law. They're already performing the law. Now look at verses 24 and 25, and it says, "And they that are Christ have crucified the flesh with its affections and lusts." The things, in other words, the things that the law forbids. They've already crucified those things to themselves. It's not that they've done away with it and said, you know, "Thou shalt not steal" no longer applies today. No, it just doesn't apply to them, because they're not about to steal, because they've crucified that lust of the flesh. And then verse 25, again, it goes back to what I had mentioned in verse 18. "If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk by the Spirit." Now, how those who walk by the Spirit are not under, operative word, the law. So how do we walk by the Spirit? How do we walk by the Spirit? Let's put this in the absolute most simplest terms that we can. How do we walk in the Spirit? By doing that which is spiritual, right? That's pretty simple. And just what is it that's spiritual according to the Word of God? And again, we just flipped the tape, and I'm about an eighth of through this message. So, anybody have another tape? We'll put another tape in. No, we'll just pick it. We'll go as far as we can, and we'll pick it up in the next message. All right, what was I saying there? I was saying that we were saying, if we're going to walk by the Spirit, we've got to do what the Bible identifies as being spiritual. Now, you can ask the question of a lot of churches today, what is being spiritual? And I'll guarantee you'll get a whole panorama of different answers, you know. But if we're going to walk by the Spirit, we'd better find out how the Bible describes spiritual, right? What is spiritual according to the Bible? Won't turn to these. I've got them in my notes here. I'll just provide them to you. Romans chapter 7, verse 14. Not only did Paul say that the law was good, he says this, verse 14, for we know that the law is spiritual. You want to walk by the Spirit? You got to do with that which is spiritual. You do the law. You perform the law of God. And then he goes on and says, but I am carnal, sold under sin. I'm the problem, not the law. And then in chapter 8 and verse 4 through 7, that one's real easy to understand. This one you've got to pay a little attention to. Listen carefully to what it says. It says that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us. Now, you cannot have the righteousness of the law being fulfilled in us without the law. You got to have the law. And he says that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. Takes us right back to Galatians 5 and 24. For they that are after the flesh do mind the things of the flesh. Those things listed that were the deeds of the flesh earlier in Galatians 5. See how these two passages tie so well together. But they that are after the Spirit do the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. You want life and peace? He tells us how. Because the carnal man is at enmity against God, for it is, now listen to this, for it, the carnal mind that is enmity with God, it says, for it is not subject to the law of God, and neither indeed can be. Which then absolutely demands that it is the spiritual man who is subject to and therefore performing the law of God, which then must be in existence for man to do so. Now, I felt it was important that we go there because, again, it was hopefully is an explanation to show how the law hasn't been done away with. It's just the way we approach the law. And whether we're above the law and performing it, therefore, or whether we're under the law because we're unwilling to abide by it. And we give our and submit ourselves to God in Christ. Now, somebody's certainly going to say, all right, we've been far enough away from the eighth commandment here in Exodus chapter 22. What does all this have to do with the eighth chapter? Well, once again, the eighth commandment, and this is how we got here. The eighth commandment not only prohibits the thief, that is, provides forced or state government for those who inclined to steal, but the eighth commandment also is designed to promote Christian responsibility, that is, self-government. And as I like to point out to my children as often as I can, much better to be self-governed than to be, I don't normally say this, state-governed, but certainly much better to be self-governed than state-governed. That's Christian government, by the way. Is self-government, except for those who won't be self-governed. But the Christian should never be under the law. It's freedom. We stand in the liberty of God's law. But better to be self-governed than to be daddy-governed, is how I usually put it to them. There's no law if you do things right. There's no law if you do things right. There's only a law when you do things wrong, because you're already performing the law. It's also designed, therefore, the Eighth Commandment, like all of the commandments, are designed to promote Christian responsibility or self-government. This latter aspect is demonstrated, we've seen it just in the, we got there by verse 5, but it's also demonstrated in several other Eighth Commandment statutes and in the remainder of Exodus, in the remainder of Exodus chapter 22 and other passages as well. So, with all of that, hopefully I haven't lost you, let's go back to Exodus chapter 22. The point being is that the Eighth Commandment since that's what we're dealing with, also promotes self-government. And these statutes fall as much under thou shalt not steal as those that are dealing with theft in a negative fashion. Exodus 22, let's pick it up with verse 6 now. It says, behold, I will stand before thee there upon the rock in... Whoops, that's not even close. That's 17. Excuse me. Exodus 22, verse 6. If fire breaks out and catch in thorns, so that the stacks of corn or the standing corn or the field be consumed therewith, he that kindleth the fire shall surely make restitution. Now, it doesn't mention in this verse that we're talking about the other field, but this is in conjunction to the previous verse about somebody's livestock getting into somebody else's field. So it's talking about if you have a, if you've started the fire in thorns or whatever, and it spreads and goes into your neighbor's field, it says that then you shall make restitution. And remember that I said that Yahweh's laws make no provision for excuses such as, well, I didn't mean for it to happen. As if that should take care of it. Grace. Give me grace here. I didn't mean for it to happen. I want grace. Listen, if you're burning trash, let's bring it to same kind of idea, a little differently, but if you're burning trash and the wind comes up and it results in your neighbor's field burning up or his haystack or even his house burning down, you are liable. After all, it was your fire, not his, that got out of control. It was you who didn't check the weather forecast, or it was you who didn't extinguish the fire when the wind whipped up. In other words, the Eighth Commandment provides for both malice and carelessness. And it's the carelessness part that usually isn't understood and applied by Christians today. However, of course, to different degrees of restitution. Restitution is always the judgment, but it's depending on the situations to different degrees. This is and this once again is case law that sets precedent. It didn't just apply to fires. It was just case law that sets a precedent, and therefore the same would then apply. For example, and we could come up with probably numerous examples, but for example, the same would apply to an automobile accident for which you were at fault. And by the way, according to Yahweh's laws, you would be responsible if you were the cause or at fault, not an insurance company. Of course, for the other person's damages. The fact is, insurance companies contribute, at least to some degree, for some people, to irresponsibility. Because you're much less likely, to be irresponsible when insured than when you yourself are fully responsible for the consequences of your own actions. And of course, the automatic response to that is to say, well, who could pay for somebody's house burning down today? Well, keep in mind, the reason their house is worth so in this day and age is at the price that it is because of all the other laws of God that we've broken because of insurance companies. That's why it's so high. And as well as rejecting other monetary laws of Yahweh. So the problem is not that the house is so high. The problem is that we've rejected God's law all along. To not be responsible, to go back to our own individual responsibility, to not be responsible for damages, even those caused by accident, would be in essence to steal from your neighbor. Would it not? In a situation in which he was not at fault. It would be saying, oh, it doesn't matter that you were damaged because I didn't mean for it to happen. So it doesn't matter. You know, just doesn't matter. And if we were able to function in that fashion, then his loss would be our theft. That's not Yahweh's way, and neither should it be our way. Now, in such situations, accidents resulting from negligence or responsibility, the law in those kinds of situations, it was restitution, it speaks of it very clearly there, But the law simply required replacement for restitution, replacement costs for restitution or compensation. In other words, the owner of the damaged property was not, catch this, was not rewarded with more than replacement costs. I'm starting to see how nice it would be under God's law rather than under man's law today. He wasn't rewarded with more than replacement costs. Furthermore, note that there's no provision in Yahweh's law for the state to make any money whatsoever via fines or penalties added to it. Now, what do you think you're going to pay? If you get an automobile accident, well, the insurance company, if you got, everybody has to have insurance for driving, and so the insurance company is going to take care of it. You've paid for it. And then on top of it, you're going to be fined if you're at fault. There's no provision for that in God's law. The state's not the damaged party. They don't deserve anything. Only the damaged party received remuneration. Period. Under God's law. Furthermore, this is a gimme. Should be a given. We may not think about it. But furthermore, there had to be a damaged party. There had to be a damaged party, unlike so many laws today against such things, for example, as speeding. Where's the damaged party? Now, if my speeding, my recklessness causes damage, that's another matter. But unlike such laws today, like speeding, or Katie helped me come up with another one. How about laws against a concealed weapon, unless you have a license? So what if I've got a concealed weapon? I don't. I don't go around with a concealed weapon. But so what if I did? As long as I don't use it unlawfully to harm or to damage someone, where's the damaged party? Or possessing firearms made illegal by the state, and a myriad of others today on the books here in America. Early American law, at a time when American law resembled more closely Yahweh's laws in this particular regard and other regards, also required a damaged party. It was known as, anybody know? Well, no, that the particular law is what I'm looking for that required a damaged party. It's corpus delicti, which has been, and you say, well, that's still in the books, but it has now been perverted in countless cases in which the state now is somehow declared as the damaged party. And so they still say, well, it's corpus delicti, the state is guilty. You know, you can, nobody's hurt, nobody's harmed, but all these laws in the book so that the state receives remuneration or payment when they haven't been damaged at all, as in with speeding laws, which is essentially nothing short, if you think about it, nothing short than socialistic communism. That's what it is. Now, I hope in these simple instructions, in just this one statute in verse 6 alone, you can see how Yahweh's law provides freedom. And that's why it's called the perfect law of liberty. Whereas man's substitute laws produce only bondage and eventually total captivity. And we're all familiar with Isaiah 5:13, where it says, therefore my people have gone into captivity because of the lack of knowledge. That verse is quoted many, many times in lots of sermons, especially amongst our people. Our people, my people, go into captivity because of the lack of knowledge. Well, what kind of knowledges are they lacking? We should really be asking here. Just not knowledge. I mean, knowledge of any kind keeps us from the freedom of truth. But in this particular instance, in Isaiah, what's it talking about? We're somewhat provided a clue in Isaiah 5 and verse 20. Same chapter, it says, woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, and put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. It's changing something. But how is that done? This is what's so often missed in this chapter when either one or both of those two verses are quoted. And it's in Isaiah 5 and verse 24 where it says, therefore, as a result, that you lack knowledge, as a result of turning good evil and evil good,
He says, therefore, as the fire devours the stubble and the flame consumeth the chaff, so their root shall be as rottenness, and their blossom shall go up as dust. Because, listen to this, because they have cast away the law of Yahweh of hosts. It's that knowledge that they go into captivity. Because the only thing that can replace that perfect law of liberty then, that vacuum, is therefore man's law, which always leads to bondage and eventual captivity in one sense or another, which always turns good into evil and evil into good. Homosexuality is no longer a capital crime. Now it's just gay people. And example after example after example. I hope you can see. I think, how much time do I have? 13 minutes. Well, I don't think I'm going to be able to cover this next section in its entirety in those 13 minutes, so I think I'll end there at this point. We'll pick this up in verses 7 through 13. If you want to read ahead, you're certainly welcome to, of course. If I tell you not to, then you certainly want to read ahead. Anytime a preacher tells you not to read a passage or look at it, you better start looking. That'll be the next section. And again, we're going to see that God's law, the Eighth Commandment in particular with these statutes, entails much more than just the prohibition against the transgression, but the promotion of self-government. One is, it does both. It promotes state government, that is, state Christian state government under God's laws, but more so than that, it expects, it promotes, it wants us to be self-governed. And the Eighth Commandment, like the other nine, all have that in mind, that we would be self-governed people, that at least as Christian people, we would be self-governed. And when we throw away God's laws, we cast it away, as it's described here in 5:24. What a description of the antinomian people today. They should wake up and realize that they are under God's judgment and say, well, that's Old Testament. Well, go read Matthew 7:21-23 again. You'll find out the same judgment. God says, I never knew you. You who practice anomia, lawlessness. Yeah. And so, I hope that you can see that two things. One is that, first of all, from this message and these two statutes that we've covered, that God's law indeed does more than just prohibit lawlessness, but promotes lawfulness as well. And secondly, that, again, I hope you can gather and get a vision that you'll want to spread it to others, that how much better it would be under the perfect law of liberty instead of under this bondage and this captivity that we are in here in America, even though so many people still call it freedom. It's not freedom. It's only freedom when you compare it to other nations that are 90% enslaved instead of 85%. You know, if you're only 85% free and everybody else is 90%, or excuse me, if you're only 85% enslaved and everybody else is 90% or 90 to 100% enslaved, boy, it looks like you got freedom. It's only because you're comparing it with the wrong thing. You know, don't compare yourselves with yourselves, is the thing Paul said. Let's compare it with God's law of liberty. And yes, we've got it good in America. And yes, it could be much worse. And it is much worse in a lot of different places. But let me tell you, if we would return to His law, it's then that we would really have it good. And it's in fact then that the rest of the nations would see what it means to follow Yahweh and the blessings that come therefrom, and they would come to our doors wanting to know what we have rather than condemning us like they do today, hating us for what we have become. God, open our eyes. Let's go to our Father and let's ask Him to do so. Heavenly Father, we are again thankful for Your Word, thankful, Father, for Your love and mercies. Thankful, Father, indeed, for the perfect law of liberty that so many of our people want to reject in one fashion or another. Open the eyes of our people. Use this message and the others to come, Father, in this series. Father, use them in a fashion that would help to, again, Father, open the eyes and hearts and minds of our people, especially Christians, Lord, at this time, that they would not, so that they might not continue to be a part of the problem, but a part of the solution of, Father, establishing Your kingdom here and now. We love You, Father, and we praise You for all that You give us, Your perfect Word and Your perfect law. We glorify You for it. Thank You for it. In Yeshua the Christ. Amen.